This is Get Lit with Literature. This is Monk. You can find out more at allbook-books.com. So this is a inconclusive follow-up, but that's going to be probably about it with the physics as metaphor. I've done a two short shows about the book, numbers 100 and 101, if you go to the website page, and then 102. Interview with Stephen T. Newcomb, fascinating conversation about the book and more, including the system of domination. And so I wanted to just wrap up because at that point I hadn't read the whole book, which I did, and I wanted to highlight what stood out to me that also stood out as one of my biggest hobbies is called Connect the Dots. Another book that was reviewed, Matthias Desmet's The Psychology of Totalitarianism, saying the same kind of thing. So that's why I like to connect the dots. I feel like at least twice or typically more kind of shows that there's a lot of validity. So the basic idea is that, like I've mentioned in Alan Watts' book many times that I haven't read, but I appreciate the title, The Wisdom of Insecurity, that in the unknown that we can find strength and embrace the uncertainties, and from that everything can be okay, rather than the massively controlled system that tends to dominate. So here's from Physics as Metaphor. Becker calls all these false heroics and lifestyles vital lies, which are necessary because our false illusions are used to maintain the equanimity to function in our everyday lives. The raw, unmitigated reality of life and death would throw most of us into a paralyzing state of fear and trembling, of absolute chaos without relief. Who wouldn't take on a few illusions and neuroses to avoid that? So, we become involved in a, quote, second-hand, unquote, struggle. Not with despair itself, but rather with our screen against despair. With the vital lies, with the, quote, stock market, sports car, atomic missiles, with the success ladder in the corporation or the competition in the university. Even in our passions, we are nursery children playing with toys that represent the real world. So I like that. I like what he's saying there, that it is not despair itself, but rather our screen against despair. Further on, he says, creating symbolic systems in society, science, religion, the home, and the mind to reinforce ourselves and give us meaning. These vital lies provide a screen against despair and the awesome horror of a meaningless life and death, but they also prevent us from facing the truth squarely. Our life struggles are secondhand and illusory. Becker is the author of a very popular book, The Denial of Death. So I like what Jones is saying there. It makes me think about that so much society and neuroses are the way we react to stuff. It is about, we're reacting to the screen and to not the actual despair. I mean, the amount of news headlines and the tragedies and stuff, it's hard to sit there and process that. I mean, with the recent earthquake and the loss of 45,000 people, I mean, I had a few existential moments where I just had no words for that or how I felt. But to actually sit and process the news, you one could spend half the day processing it. So whether you do that or not, I think just something to ponder with Roger Jones is now. Also then in Matthias's book, Desmet, in The Psychology of Totalitarianism, Desmet writes, totalitarianism is the ultimate attempt to rid ourselves of this uncertainty by withdrawing into a pseudo-scientific certainty and merciless logic, by trying to reduce symbols to signs and by trying to annihilate all variety in cultural expression. Totalitarianism obliterates such diversity in every possible way. The systematized and industrialized transportation, exploitation, and murder of population groups in labor and extermination camps are historical examples indelibly engraved in our minds. The logic of a totalitarian system is in constant flux and typically becomes ever more absurd. The raison d'etre of a totalitarian system consists of, among others, channeling anxiety, which is why it must constantly identify new objects of anxiety. When the system is no longer able to link anxiety to an object, it loses its raison d'etre. When the system is no longer able to link anxiety to an object, it loses its raison d'etre. Both Nazism and Stalinism were constantly restructuring themselves. The essence of the phenomenon of totalitarianism lies in its dynamics. The directives and decrees are constantly changing because it is imperative to create new responses to new threats. So that's one of my quote favorite quotes is Karl Rove, who said, "We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. And while you're studying that reality, judiciously as you will, we'll act again, creating other new realities, which you can study too. And that's how things will sort out. We're just history's actors. And you, all of you, will be left to just study what we do." So there is an obvious anthropocentric sociopathology in this kind of behavior, and that's what the media, that's what the news reflects, is constant anxiety to get you leaping from one anxiety to the next. The timing of just as the COVID pandemic, just as that was waning. I remember it was almost to the day, the headline, COVID pandemic waiting, next day. Russia and Ukraine, the war, so and that became, that's still going, that the, every day the headlines. So that's the constant, it's like the uncertainty in the news is the screen. I mean, not that it's not real, but that, the way we process, that becomes it's programmed, that becomes the anxiety, but do we ever actually deal with the deeper anxiety, or the deeper uncertainty, because if we just stop to slow down, we would have to face our actual day-to-day uncertainties and anxieties, but instead, the way I see it, the system of domination, whatever you call it, totalitarianism, Nazism, Stalinism, the status quo, it is always trying to regulate and do everything by rote. So everybody's in line. Everybody's doing the same thing. It's a subtle form of comfort because then you don't have to worry about stuff. You don't have to face the uncertainty. And part of facing the uncertainty is being receptive to the moment. To being receptive to any kind of inner guidance or what, you know, what's going on. And that is something actually that Jones ends the book on, but I'm just going to flip through and read some of my highlights, highlight quotes. "But if we reject dualism, human responsibility becomes genuine, deep, and pervasive. There are not two separate worlds, there is one. We participate in it and we help to make and sustain it. We are responsible not only for other creatures, but for everything in this cosmos, for the very space-time in which all exists." Here he addresses what I mentioned before. "Tragic because we doom ourselves to alienated existence by refusing to recognize our own needs and our power to create the meaning that sustains us." I find that often in life and as in living and as a writer, that sometimes the actual act, say the act of writing a poem, I feel like I'm creating some meaning that helps me overcome, you know, those existential crisis moments. But in the act of creating, I create meaning. And then if I share it with someone and they like it, then that's, you know, that extends. The energy is creative rather than getting lost in the stuck zone. And here he gets to all mystics, what I would just group together as mystics, indigenous peoples, and farmers, alchemists. Here he talks to, "But the alchemists, their material manipulations were just an allegory of the far more important internal process of spiritual purification. Their goal was not control over nature and the raping of its wealth, but the enlightenment of themselves and the human race. How many modern scientists and engineers can say the same?" And that is true in my experience, as alchemy is part of spiritual alchemy is part of my path, that the goal is to work on yourself and to transmute your own energies, not to you know, not to try to control nature and the world. And then the opposite of that, that man-made control is the, here he gets at it, the laws of physics imply that all electric charge is susceptible to the electric field. Is there some stronger force that holds the electron together? But what is the nature of this force? Wouldn't this new force also be generated by some elementary particle as its source, just as the electron is the source of the electric field? And what would keep this new particle from exploding or collapsing under its own influence? Or are we to introduce a sequence of stronger and stronger forces in infinitum, each successive force explaining its predecessor? To that, I would say that's what people refer to as the sun behind the sun, what I've heard called the natural law. Recall that physics as metaphor means not taking the physical too literally. And he wraps up the book with quite fascinating image, and you know, he's talking about birds and there's some of what they do. It is from our internally felt sensations and their relationships, talking about the human and the internal and the birds. I cannot help but wonder what this research would look like if approached from the viewpoint of alternative space metaphors instead of our common idolatrous one. We try to understand bird navigation in terms of spatial and causal mechanisms. All these explanatory mechanisms seem to place the cart before the horse. Star, sun, and magnetic navigation represent abstract projections of subjectively experienced relationships. Earlier forms of consciousness experience these as organic, astrological, or mythic. It is from our internally felt sensations in their relationships that we build our notions of space and project an external world. Is it any wonder now that we should find gravity, magnetism, and sunlight out there? How else are we to understand birds flying great distances through space and doing pinpoint navigation? Perhaps for the bird, it's more like sitting in a movie theater and watching the flight go by on the screen, knowing all the while that the destination is a foreordained and recorded there at the end of the film. The bird must supply the creative energy, but it's more like running the projector than physically moving through space. The whole thing is coiled up on the film in the bird's head. He doesn't go anywhere. He just runs his movie. How can he miss a target? It was there on the film all along. Now, I find that very fascinating because that's some of what somehow I plan my day is, you know, the night before or in that morning I will meditate and receive information and visualize so that I've kind of visualized where I'm going to go if I'm going to do errands. It's like, okay, A, B, C, D, E, and then you know, once I get in the car and go, it's like, it is very much like that. The whole thing is coiled up on the film in the bird's head. He doesn't go anywhere. He just runs his movie. That does make it, reduces anxiety. It helps me feel like it's a comfort and a flow, just go from one thing to the next instead of like, you know, oh, what time is it? How am I going to get there? Blah, blah, blah. And then the last paragraph or so of the book, it's all very much like the business of numbers and time in chapter 6. There's the coiled up state in which numbers and time are symbolic, synchronistic, potential, and simultaneous. And there's the uncoiled state characterized as sequential, causal, actualized, and linear. What appears as a causal sequence to us may be more of a synchronistic, mythic, dynamic pattern to the bird. For him, it's like von Franz's fluttering dragonfly. He's got all his necessary information coiled up inside him, maybe imprinted somewhere in his cells along with the genetic code. There must be some reason why we picture the DNA molecule as a spiral. You protest. How could anyone ever know such things? How could we ever have faith in such information or test it? Well, we might learn to trust inner voices, or to hear a little bird whispering in our ears, a cardinal, perhaps. So I love that. I love that ending to Roger S. Jones's Physics as Metaphor, because after all the you know, the science and time, space, matter, and number, and exploring the physics and those phenomenon, he also highlights that is basically, I'm just summing up like a kind of linear left brain mode, but that to be whole, we have to include the intuition and the inner voice and the voices and the visuals and whatever else is sensory there, that to add that to the mix and not be overruled and dominated by the rules of the system and science as a totally literal fact. Because if we buy into the science as always the only literal fact, we will miss the other bits. So thank you for listening and be well.